a profile of a servant leader. And in order just to have something to peg our ideas on, we'll use an acrostic of the word leadership here. Just one or two preliminary thoughts about leadership. I think one of the things that we have to come to terms with is that there is a considerable degree of disillusionment with leadership in our cultures at the present time. And this in many ways is understandable, because there are plenty of examples of people given the privilege of leadership who've abused that privilege. And a certain degree of skepticism and cynicism has developed concerning many of our leaders. And yet, at the same time that there is a skepticism and cynicism about leadership, there is very often a cry for leadership. They may not put it in those terms, but people will see a problem, and the kind of thing that you'll hear people say constantly is, when is somebody going to do something about this? Or, why doesn't somebody do something? Well, that's a cry for leadership. And so there's something of an anomaly here. On the one hand, a degree of skepticism about leadership. On the other hand, an inherent desire for leadership. What this means, as far as the church is concerned, is that we need to be thinking very clearly on this whole subject. Many people have studied many different churches and have tried to identify characteristics that are to be found in various healthy churches. And one of the things that constantly comes up in the research is where there is a healthy church, there's almost inevitably godly leadership. And so this is something we need to be concerned about. First of all, a definition of what I would understand by a leader. A leader is a person with the ability to give people a vision. That presupposes that the leader has the ability to identify a vision, but then has the ability to articulate that vision. There are visionaries who have all kinds of ideas, but they are not necessarily able to articulate that vision to people. So a leader is a person with the ability to give people a vision and at the same time to afford them with opportunities to achieve an objective which they are desirous, willing, and able to embrace. I'll go over that again, and obviously we could spend a lot of time looking at each phrase of that. A leader is a person with the ability to give people a vision and an opportunity. It's one thing to give people the vision, it's another thing to give people the opportunity to see that vision actualized. I think I told you about my chairman of my board at one stage who said that, maybe I didn't say this. I've said so many things and I wasn't paying attention that I'm probably in danger of repeating myself, but just look interested if I do. I'm almost 70 and so you have to understand that this happens with advancing years. But when we were looking at building a new building, there was a big debate as to how big we should build it. And the chairman of my board said, it doesn't matter how big we build it, you'll fill it with disgruntled people. And so I said, well, thank you very much, I think. Would you mind explaining that? He said, yes. He said, you are a world-class motivator and a hopeless mobilizer. And the way to frustrate people and get them disgruntled is to get them all fired up by way of motivation and not mobilize them. In other words, get them all fired up about this is what we ought to be doing, but not provide them with the opportunity to do it. And I said, well, people should be able to figure that out for themselves. He said, there are some people who are self-starters. They are in the minority. And the leader is the person who not only can see a vision and can articulate the vision, but will provide opportunities for the vision to be actualized. Now, what is the vision to be? Well, the vision is something that people will want to be part of. It's something that they would like to identify with. Why would they want to be part of it? Why would they identify with it? It's because it is something that they feel able to be part of. It is something that they are willing to be part of. It is something that they are desirous of being part of. And all those three things are all important. It is possible to have some people who are desirous of being part of something, but they're totally unable to do it. There are some people who are very able to be part of it, but they are singularly unwilling to be part of it. And so the leader's task is to have the vision, to articulate the vision in such a way that people will recognize there's an opportunity for me to be part of this thing here, because I'm both desirous and willing and able to be part of it. Now, there are some things that we need to recognize about leadership, and it is this, that leadership is not a flash in the pan. That leadership is something that engages people over an extended period of time. It is a process in which people are given the opportunity not only to see an objective, but are given the time to see it come to fruition. So the leader who comes up with a great idea and then packs his bag and splits is maybe a visionary. I would submit to you, he or she is not a leader. Now, there is no shortage of books on leadership. In fact, we seem to be almost swamped with them at the present time. And one of the things that is rather interesting to me about the books that are coming out on Christian leadership is that almost invariably they start off by looking at secular leadership and then explain all that and put a few verses in as a sort of a substantiation of the points that are made. Now, this does not mean that invalidates them. What it does mean, however, is that sometimes there's a blurring of the marked distinction between secular leadership and, for want of a better term, Christian leadership. Let me give you what I believe are three critical distinctives of Christian leadership. First of all, Christian leadership is unique in that it envisions goals in the context of the divine will. It envisions goals in the context of the divine will. Secular leadership doesn't have to bother itself with the divine will. It has great freedom. It can dream all kinds of dreams. It can envision all kinds of visions. It may not even believe there is a God. It may believe there is a God fundamental irrelevance. But the Christian leader has his or her focus severely limited in that the Christian leader is only free to envision goals that there is solid reason to believe are to be found in the context of the divine will. There's the first distinctive. The second distinctive of Christian leadership is this, that Christian leadership must see people that it is trying to involve in the leadership experience. It must see these people as being created in the divine image. Secular leadership doesn't have to bother about that. If we see people created in the divine image, we will of necessity, by definition, be required to treat them in a certain way. Secular leadership that doesn't see people created in the divine image will be perfectly free to view people as simply means to an end, simply as numbers on the ground, simply as warm bodies, simply as dispensable. And the Christian leader is not free to do that. You do not treat somebody created in the divine image in that way. So there's another limiting factor in Christian leadership. Christian leadership is unique in the envisions goals in the context of the divine will and is careful to see people as created in the divine image. And thirdly, Christian leadership at all times recognizes that the leader should reflect the divine nature. This, again, is something that secular leadership doesn't have to be bothered with. at all. In other words, very, very often we will find leaders whose lives are abysmal. But because they are able to communicate a vision, get people fired up, get them mobilized into it and achieve that vision, then people simply overlook what they are as people and simply say, he's a great leader. Now, I don't want to name any names, but we have a glaring example of that in the United States at the present time. He lives in the White House. Now, but I would not want to mention names. It's very interesting. Actually, it is very interesting to notice that if you talk to Americans, and obviously they're all over the waterfront in their opinions, but if you talk to Americans in general and look at the omnipresent polls, the polls in America would show a very, very high approval rating of President Clinton as president and abysmal ratings of Bill Clinton as a person. But they are able very conveniently to dichotomize the two. They really, quite frankly, don't care what kind of a person he is, just so long as he, quote, does his job. And his job is not defined in terms of character. His job, in their thinking, is simply defined in terms of leading us where we want to go. Now, we'll see immediately that there's a very, very different approach to Christian leadership from secular leadership. Let me just give you that statement again. Christian leadership is unique in that it envisions goals in the context of the divine will, is careful to see people as created in the divine image, and at all times recognizes the leader's character should reflect the divine nature. Peter Kuzmik has come up with a very interesting statement. He says that charisma without character produces chaos. Charisma without character produces chaos. Peter told me actually that he was being interviewed live on television and he came out with that statement, never having thought of it before, and it has literally gone around the world since. It's rather a clever statement in that each of those three English words in actual fact is a Greek word. Charisma without character produces chaos. So if you weren't particularly fluent in Greek, now you've got three words that you can be fluent in. All right, well, so just one or two preliminary thoughts there about leadership. Now, I'd like simply to use our acrostic here by way of identifying some of the characteristics of a Christian leader. L stands for love, which I would submit to you immediately sets Christian leadership apart from secular leadership. One of the things that you can realistically expect from a Christian leader is that that leader is leading people out of a genuine love for those people, a genuine concern, interest, and interest in them. One of the difficult expressions that has found its way to us, basically from the scriptures, is the expression servant leader. Servant leader. In many people's thinking, servant leader is an oxymoron. I collect oxymorons. You know what an oxymoron is? It is a statement that includes two ideas that are mutually contradictory, like jumbo shrimp or military intelligence. I was talking to some of my grandsons. Yeah, I'm sure we can go endlessly on these. And if you have some good ones, let me know afterwards. I was talking to two of my grandsons the other day, and I told them that I thought an oxymoron that they need to be aware of is rap music. So they did not agree. They say Beethoven gives them a headache, and I say, well, you need some more headaches. Anyway, that's by the way. Here's this oxymoronic statement, servant leadership. Some people would say you either serve people or you lead them. The Lord Jesus gave us a rather striking example of leadership when he and his disciples arrived at a house. Nobody provided the customary courtesies of washing their feet. Jesus went about it and did it himself. Said that he had given them an example, and that if they knew these things, they'd be blessed if they did them. And went on to explain that he did not come to be served, he came to serve. And here we have the quintessential leader, the leader of our faith. And he is leading by serving. Now, how does this practically work out? Let me suggest to you, this is only a suggestion, let me suggest to you that servant leadership, or leadership that is driven by love for the people being led, is leadership that leads people into that which will, in the long term, serve their best interests. Now, I want to be quite specific about that. Loving leadership, or servant leadership, is leadership that leads people into that which in the long term will serve their best interest. Now, it's rather easy to draw a distinction here. Because not infrequently, in leadership, there is a sense in which a strong leader has a clear vision, great determination to develop the vision, and clear-cut objectives and goals, and great determination to get to them, and they will gather people in their wake and use them and abuse them. And not infrequently, we find great leaders who've achieved their objective and left in their wake broken lives. Christian leaders don't do that. Christian leaders love the people. They lead in such a way that they serve. And so I would repeat that loving leadership, or servant leadership, is all about leading people into that which in the long term will serve their best interest. One of the women on our pastoral team was interviewed some time ago, and I hope this doesn't sound self-serving, but because it's not intended to be, but this particular person interviewing my staff asked what is a distinctive about the way I lead the staff. And she said, and this was a surprise to me, but it gave me a seed of an idea. She said, "I don't ever remember Stuart asking me, 'What are you doing?' without first asking me, 'How are you doing?'" And she said, "I get the impression that he trusts me and loves me enough to assume that if I'm doing well, I'll be doing my job properly. And he is not so much interested in what I am producing, he is more interested in how I am doing." Now, I don't know if that was a valid understanding of the situation, but that was what she said. I would suggest it's called servant leadership. L stands for love. E stands for enthusiasm. E stands for enthusiasm. Emerson said, "Nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm." It's rather unfortunate that during the days of the Wesleyan revivals in England, the good, old, strong, Puritan, Reformed Anglicans were very, very skeptical of these Wesleyans. And they called them enthusiasts. And one of the worst things that you could say about anybody in those days, if you're a good, solid, Reformed Anglican, one of the worst things you'd ever say about anybody was, "He is an enthusiast." And there's a very, very famous gravestone in a graveyard in England where a venerable old Anglican minister is buried, and it says basically, "Here lies so-and-so who served this parish for 45 years without enthusiasm." And that is intended to be a compliment. Isn't it interesting how words can change their meaning? Would you want your epitaph to be, "Here lies so-and-so, he served God without enthusiasm"? I doubt it. Now, of course, the word enthusiasm comes from the Greek. It's rather easy to figure out what it is. En theos. And some people would actually add mania. So that enthusiasm is en theos mania. Into God mania. The Greeks believed that somebody who was enthusiastic was enthusiastic for the very simple reason the gods had got into them. What a delightful concept. The gods had got into them. Or, if you like, they had got into the gods. It was this concept of the gods. It was this concept of transcendence invading their lives that was generating within them this great sense of enthusiasm. By enthusiasm, I would mean the generating of a strong sense of purposefulness and worthwhileness that motivates yourself and is contagious and begins to motivate others. In Wisconsin, where I live, the local National Football League team is the famous Green Bay Packers. Even people who don't know much about American football, many of them have heard of the Green Bay Packers. And they had a legendary coach for many years called Vince Lombardi. Now, Vince Lombardi was the source of a constant stream of aphorisms. If he spoke as many aphorisms as people say he did, I have no idea when he had time to coach his football team. But anyway, on one occasion, he is reputed to have said to his players, "If you are not fired with enthusiasm, you will be fired with enthusiasm." Now, I rather like that. If you're not fired with enthusiasm, you will be fired with enthusiasm. Now, of course, he uses fired as a synonym of sacked. You sacked here? Yeah, but I think you get the point there. Of course, fully recognize that pastors don't have the privilege of firing the less than enthusiastic in their congregations. Now, granted, it would be wonderful, wonderful privilege to do that. Unfortunately, the situation is often reversed. And the pastor is the one who is fired with enthusiasm, and his only crime is he was fired with enthusiasm. But that's by the way. So, let's ask ourselves. Is it possible to maintain a sense of enthusiasm about the ministry? I love what the Apostle Paul says in Romans chapter 1. In all probability, he was an older man by this time. And when he writes to the Romans, he said, "Now I'm planning to come to Rome. I haven't been there before. I'm looking forward very much to being there. And while I'm there, I'd like actually to go on to Spain." Now, he'd come to the stage where he could reasonably have been expected to be thinking about retirement and getting a nice little whitewashed cottage overlooking the Aegean Sea and pruning roses. But at this particular time, there is still this fire of enthusiasm. "I want to go to Rome. That's where the action is." It's a dangerous place. I fully recognize that. And he found out he lost his head there. It's a dangerous place, it's a difficult place, it's a dirty place, and that's where I want to go. And while I'm there, I may as well hop over to Spain as well, and just see how things are going there. And of course, Spain in those days was regarded as the edge of the Mediterranean, and whether Paul believed the world was flat or not, I don't know. But there was always the possibility, if you went beyond the Straits of Gibraltar, you fell off the edge, and Paul says, "Let's go anyway." Called enthusiasm. I was talking to Ian Thomas a year or two ago, in his 80s now. He had a profound influence on my life in earlier years. And we were talking about the good old days when we used to occasionally slip behind the Iron Curtain. We worked in Europe and, well, we went all over Western Europe, and once in a while we'd poke our noses behind the Iron Curtain in some of the Eastern European countries. And we were talking about the fact that the Iron Curtain no longer exists now. And we not only talk about Western Europe, we talk about Central Europe, and we talk about Eastern Europe, and then we talk about the Asian former Soviet republics. And the whole thing is wide open, crying out for ministry. And Ian Thomas, in his mid-80s, reminiscing about all this, with his blue eyes flashing, said, "Don't you wish you had another life?" It's called enthusiasm. It's called enthusiasm. And what we're looking for, of course, in the Church of Jesus Christ, is those who are fired with enthusiasm, who have the ability to fire others with enthusiasm. A stands for adaptability. Adaptability. Let me explain what I mean by that, and you say, please do. One of the things that the Apostle Paul said about his ministry was this. He said, to the Jew, I become like a Jew. To those under the law, I become like somebody under the law. To those not under the law, I become like somebody not under the law. He says, I have become all things to all men, that I might by all possible means win some. Now, I don't know if you've noticed this. This expression, all things to all men, has been lifted right out of its context and very often is used as an insult. Well, this guy is just all things to all men. They often say this of politicians. Politicians who have the remarkable ability of saying exactly what people want to hear. There's a lovely story about an American senator who was running for re-election in one of the deep south states. And he went to one little town where the big issue there was squirrel hunting. And they were trying to get him to take a stand on squirrel hunting. And they said, "Senator, what is your position on squirrel hunting?" And he said, "Some of my friends are avid squirrel hunters. And some of my friends are strongly opposed to squirrel hunting. And as a matter of principle, I stand firmly with my friends." Now think about that. That is a fine political position. All things to all men. That is not, emphatically not, what Paul is saying. What Paul is saying is this, that within the parameters of what it is that we're called to do, there has to be the ability to adapt to certain situations. Cultures different. People differ. Ages differ. Times change. Some things don't change. Other things are changeable. This is one of the tricky areas in ministry today. There are some people who are rooted in tradition. And as far as being rooted in tradition is concerned, their favorite verse is, "As it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, world without end. Amen." The seven last words of that church are, "We never did it this way before." And of course, they are inflexible. They are rigid in their position. Now, they would say that they are conserving the faith. The faith once for all delivered to the saints. And we must hold firmly to that. If that is what they're doing, they're right. If, on the other hand, they are confusing substance with style, they're wrong. For substance must not change. Style must. Because we're going to discover that we are addressing totally changing situations. So what I'm talking about here is the ability to adapt. Sometimes the person who is committed to doing it this way and only this way has a fixity of purpose that is basically rigidity, and this rigidity is born of insecurity. Now that is hard for some people to hear, but I believe it needs to be said. Sometimes a fixity of purpose is based on a rigidity of methodology that is indicative of insecurity. There is a place for tradition. There is a place for history. I worry deeply about what is happening in many dimensions of the contemporary church. I almost go into some churches now and get the feeling from that church that they are the ones who think that they're the first generation to get church right. You know why? Because there is no reference whatsoever to 2,000 years of church history. No recognition of it at all. Let me give you a couple of examples here. If you check in the Psalms, you'll find in the Psalms, many of the Psalms were written for the choral master. You can go back into the Psalms, 3,000 years. You can go back earlier than 3,000 years, and you'll find over 3,000 years of history, the church has honored and respected and responded to choral music. We're living in a generation now that will totally scrap choral music, and for the first time in 3,000 years plus, we will do without something that the church has not managed to do without for 3,000 years. Now that is a troubling thing to me. Another thing that's happening in the church at the present time, in this all hot button of music, boy, what a hot button it is, one thing that the church has always managed to do is sing in harmony. They can't do it anymore. Why? Because we have words projected, but we have no musical notation provided. Now, I'm not stuck in this whole business of you've got to have a hymn book, and I'm not suggesting that you're more holy because you project it, or you're more holy because you have a hymn book. All I'm saying is this. Historically and traditionally, the church has appreciated choral music. This generation is losing it. Historically and traditionally, the church has sung in harmony. This generation is losing it. Is that the way to go? Well, that's something that you can ponder in your own mind. Having said that, there is a place for history. There is a place for tradition. We have a historical faith. We are a historic church. On the other hand, it is possible for us simply to have traditions for the sake of tradition and not even have a clue why the traditions were born. Now, tradition can be, at its best, a repository of experience. Why reinvent the wheel would be the argument for tradition. And if that is the case, that's very beneficial. The situation very often, however, is that traditions are simply the perpetuation of something that is now totally anachronistic. When a head of state arrives in a country, it is not unusual to have a 21-gun salute. The howitzers that fire the 21-gun salute have a crew of 5 people. But they only need 4 to fire the gun. The 5th one was there to hold the horse. But he's still there. No horse, but he's still there. As it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. One of my favorite stories is of the young couple. They hadn't been married very long. And you can tell they hadn't been married very long because he still hung around the kitchen. It was Easter and she was boiling a ham. He noticed that she cut both ends off the ham, put it and boiled it. And he said to her, why did you do that? She said, that's how you boil a ham. He said, who told you that? She said, my mother. When he saw his mother-in-law, he said, mother-in-law, how do you boil a ham? She said, you cut both ends off a ham, put it in a pan, and
body.
This is another of these illustrations that comes in very useful if you have a lot of time and not much material to fill it. Remember? I told you, make sure you've always got some of those handy. But I do have enough material. So he goes back to Grandma, and he says, Grandma, how do you boil a ham? And she said, I cut both ends off it, and I put it in a pan and boiled. And he said, why? And she said, because my pan isn't big enough. Now, not only was the pan not big enough, it wasn't big enough at both ends. And so old Grandma cut something off both ends. Now, her daughter sees her doing that, unthinkingly perpetuates it, and her daughter sees that, and unthinkingly perpetuates it, and the Church of Jesus Christ, in many instances, is totally rigid and inflexible and unwilling to adapt, because she is simply doing what she's always done the way she's always done it. What we're looking for is the ability to conserve that which is of substance and the ability to flex in terms of style. What we're looking for is the ability to know the point at which we maintain the traditions that are value and the willingness to scrap the traditions that are now a hindrance to the work. It's called adaptability. Now, how you do it, that's your problem. It's just my idea of showing how we need to be doing this. Let me suggest to you that when we're thinking in terms of adaptability, when we're thinking or thinking in terms of change, we're thinking about one of the most problematic areas of Christian leadership. Look at it this way. I firmly believe that a church that is disinterested in progress is a church that has lost its way. And I'll tell you why. This world of ours is just booming. When I was born in 1930, there were 2 billion people on the face of God's earth. Because I was living at the right speed, I was 40 in 1970. There were 4 billion people on the face of God's earth. Because I have continued my relentless progress, I will be 70 at the end of this year, and there will be more than 6 billion people on the face of God's earth. What that means is, in my 70 years, the world's population will have tripled. It took from the beginning of time to get the first 2 billion. It took 40 years to get the next 2 billion. It took about 25 years to get the next 2 billion. Does that tell you anything? What it tells you is this, that we have a burgeoning population. What it doesn't tell us is that the population is burgeoning in regions of the world where Christ is least known. Any church that knows that and is committed to the status quo, I submit, has lost its way. It's lost its vision. What that means then is that a healthy church will be concerned about progress. You cannot have progress without change. Therefore, the adaptable leader is the person who understands progress, understands change, anticipates reactions, and is able to handle people and lead them through change. Adaptability, one of the critical issues of leadership in the church. Now, granted, there are many churches that don't change, many churches that make no progress, many churches that plateaued a long time ago, and it isn't long when you plateau until you slip inexorably into decline. What we need to be looking at is this whole idea of adaptability, change. Let me give you an example of some change that we felt was necessary in our church back home. Here's a case study for you.
I think it may be of interest to you.
It was very obvious in the church, which I'm privileged to serve, that the constitution that was established 42 years ago by 13 people was no longer viable now that there were thousands of people. It's one thing to have a constitution established by 13 people. It's an entirely different thing to have a church that is comprised of thousands of people. The constitution wasn't working. Everybody knew it. Everybody was saying, this thing doesn't work. Something ought to be done. So I thought, all right, I'll do it. So I wrote up a one-page proposal. A one-page proposal to change the constitution. Now, Alan Redpath had told me when I was going to be a pastor, Stuart, knowing you as I do, he said, I'll give you 12 months. Provided you avoid a building program and a constitutional revision, for both are the kiss of death. Well, Alan was a rotten prophet and a great expositor. 30 years later, I'm still there, having survived constitutional revisions and numerous building programs. That's by the way. So, I write up a one-page proposal. If you want to change something, write up a one-page proposal. Any longer, they won't read it. This one-page proposal says we have an unworkable constitution. Two of the areas that are unworkable are, number one, the way our council, our board of deacons operates. We had a new deacons every 3 years. That meant a third of them every year. So that meant every year we spend half the year going over what we'd done the previous year. And the new guys wanted to alter what had been decided the previous two. 3 years was not a practical situation. Now the two problem. The people were asked to elect deacons. But the church was so big now, they hadn't a clue who they were. We knew they didn't know who they were. Because I observed that when we would give a slate of people for them to vote on, the people whose names were at the beginning of the list alphabetically always got in, and the people at the end didn't. So 1 year I didn't tell anybody, I reversed the list, and the guys at the end of the list got in, and the guys at the beginning didn't. People would call me and say, you've given us 6 names, you've got to vote for 3, I only know 2, give me another one I should vote for. Somebody else called me and said, I only know one of them and I don't know him, but I'm going to vote for him because his wife's a lovely singer. Now, this was the leadership of the church. You see, it obviously didn't work. So, my proposal was very simple. That the board of deacons, listen very carefully, you heard it right, the board of deacons should unanimously vote themselves into extinction. Number 2, that the congregation should vote themselves out of a vote for their leadership. The chances of that happening are slightly less than nil. When I presented my one-page thing to some of the key opinion formers, and by the way, when you've written up your one-page proposal, take it to your opinion formers in the church. If you don't know who they are, find out quickly. Take it to the opinion formers in the church. The leader of the opinion formers in the church looked at it, threw it down on the table, and said, only a Brit could have written this. This is positively un-American. All right, well, I said, it's nothing to do with America or Britain, but okay, that's fine. Anyway, I talked to him about it, talked to the other opinion formers about it. They said, well, take it to the board of deacons. They knew it wouldn't stand a chance of survival. Took it to the board of deacons. We had a wonderful, loving, caring meeting. You can imagine. After they had kicked it and ripped it for about 3 hours, I said to them, it is a well-established fact that any jackass can kick down a barn. It takes a craftsman to build one. Are there any craftsmen here tonight? Well, give them credit. They're a great bunch, you see. Somebody started laughing, then somebody else started laughing, and we all began laughing at ourselves because nobody had had a positive thought. Everybody was just negative. Any jackass can kick down a barn. What we need is some craftsmen to build it. So, to cut the long story short, they did what you do in a case like that. They referred it to a subcommittee. They asked for volunteers for the subcommittee. Guess who volunteered for the subcommittee? all those most violently and vociferously opposed to it. Of course. I was leaving for India the next day. So I was thinking, okay, well, it was a noble attempt, but it's, you know, it went down with its flag slang. I said to them, look, I'm leaving. This is a proposal. Nobody else has proposed a thing. Only negative reactions to it. Either somebody else comes up with another proposal, or take another look at this. The only thing I ask is, I want my young associate, Mel Lorenz, on this committee, on this subcommittee with you. I went to India for a month, didn't hear a word about what was happening, except for a PS on the bottom of an airmail from Mel on my wife's email, airmail. And this is what the PS says. PS, we've unanimously decided on an Episcopal form of government, and you are the new Archbishop. That was it. That was all I heard on the whole thing. Very, very helpful, Mel. Thank you so much. When I came back, the subcommittee were 100% in favor of the move. They'd had time to think it through. They brought it to the Board of Deacons. They then became the main arguers in favor of it. They saw the wisdom of what was being said. I'm only giving you a little bit of what was proposed. Then they said, okay, let's do it. But the congregation was the only group who could change the constitution. Now it's got to go to the congregation. What are the chances of the congregation voting themselves out of a vote? Slightly less than nil. But what were the chances of the deacons voting themselves into extinction? Slightly less than nil. They've agreed to that now. Now we go to the congregation. We start off by a six-week series preaching the epistle of Paul to Titus, all about finishing off what's been started in Crete and the appointment of elders and leadership in the church. You've got to start from the word, you've got to start from the pulpit. If you're going to affect change, then you've got to be able to give a solid biblical rationale for it. But in addition to that, we then presented the proposal to the congregation and hurriedly said, no decision will be made for 12 months. No decision will be made for 12 months. And only you can make the decision. So don't let's hear any talking about railroading, ramming it down our throats, perpetuation of an old boys' club. Don't let's hear any of that stuff. The only people who can change it are you. And if you don't change it, nothing will be changed. And you've got a year to think about it. Then we start arranging meetings where they can vent. And oh, do they vent. Oh, do they ask their questions. Oh, do they express their opinions. And you listen patiently to them and you respond to them because you see, you know what's going on. You're thinking progress and change. They are thinking threat and uncertainty. And what you've got to show them is that they do not need to feel threatened because they're the only ones who can change it. And they need not think in terms of uncertainty because what you're actually doing is trying to show them that this is something that will actually achieve what they've actually been asking for. We met with small groups. We went all over the place and spent endless hours on it. The principle of change is this. We call it the pebble in the pool method. The pebble in the pool, you take the pebble of an idea and you drop it in the pool of people's thinking. Then you gently waft it. And it causes ripples. Sometimes the ripples resemble tidal waves. But if you watch the ripples carefully, they will eventually hit the bank. And then something very wonderful happens. You know what it is? They start coming back. And that's the critical point. The critical point is you drop the pebble of an idea into the pool of people's thinking. You give them time to work on it until in the end they begin to take ownership of the idea themselves. And beginning to take ownership of the idea themselves, they then begin to be the ones who are pressing for it. They began to come and say, look, you said we've got 12 months to make a decision on this. Let's do it. We don't have to wait 12 months. Let's just do it. And he said, no. We said 12 months. We'll wait 12 months. The great day came. The great meeting. We have a problem getting people to show up for our annual general meeting. Anyway, they showed up for this one, obviously. That's by the way. They showed up for this one. John Schmidtke, big old John, got up and said, well, I'm opposed to this proposal, and I have 24 reasons. He got a big yellow legal pad, and he starts to work his weary way through. He's got through about 12 of his reasons when people say, okay, John, you've made your point. You know, thank you, John. Sit down, John. The natives were getting restless. In the end, the chairman calls for the question, the vote, to vote themselves out of a boat, and to vote the council, the board of deacons, into extinction, and to put in its place an entirely new system of choosing leaders, etc., etc. I won't go into the details of that. The vote came down. I don't know how many in favour, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds in favour. The critical point was 2 against. 2 against. John Schmidtke and his wife Diane, who got up and stamped out and slammed the door behind them. 6 months later, came back. And I saw John back in, and I put my arm around his shoulder. I said, John, it's good to see you again. I said, bad as we are, it's worse out there, right? Actually, John came to, this was years and years ago, probably 15, 18 years ago now. John came to my study last week, and he said, I think God's calling me into ministry. Can you help me find where I need to be? Now, I give you that as an example, a case study of the kind of change that can be brought about. What are the keys? Leadership needs to give a lead. It needs to give a lead in such a way that people have the opportunity to react, have their fears dealt with, have their questions answered, until in the end they begin to see the wisdom of it and begin to buy into it. And you've got to give them time. Give them time. One of the churches that we planted got into a big problem. The young pastor there was devastated by it. Came to see me in tears. He said, I don't know what went wrong. I said, well, what did you do? He said, I just dropped the pebble in the pool. I said, well, tell me about the pebble and tell me about the pool. So he told me about the pebble in the pool, and I started laughing. I said, you didn't drop a pebble in the pool. You dropped a boulder in a bathtub. And that's the way to get people angry and antagonistic. Pebble in the pool, not boulder. Well, I've gone on far too long on that. That may be of interest. D. Oh, one other thing. There's a pastor went to a church. When he got there, the pastor was on the piano was on the left side of the pulpit, and he felt very strongly it should be on the right side, so he moved it. When he came back next Sunday, it was on the left again. He thought no one had told the janitor, so he moved it on the right side. The elders called him in and said, listen, the people who donated that piano, if you look on it, there's a plaque in memory of a former pastor. They said that that must be on the left side of the pulpit. Who do you think you are to change that? Well, he said, I just felt that it would be more appropriate to have it on the right side. Well, we're not interested in what you think is appropriate. You leave it there. He felt very strongly it should be moved. They felt very strongly it should be there. So he handled the situation very, very well. He moved it half an inch a week. And that's how you get change in the church. Okay. D. D stands for dedication. Obviously, dedication is related to this whole business of being set apart. We've been thinking about that. What I mean by this is that leadership needs to demonstrate a willingness for set-apartedness. Or, to put it another way, leadership has got to accept the fact that leadership does not operate at the level that the fellowship operates. Well, one of the oil companies in America had an advertisement which said, "You expect more from a leader." That was a purely secular understanding. It is a spiritual understanding too. If a leader is not prepared to put out more than the people he or she is trying to lead, it is highly unlikely that they will generate much enthusiasm or much momentum. There needs to be a set-apartedness. I love one of the things by Longfellow. This is what he said. "The heights by great men reached and kept were not attained by sudden flight. But they, while their companions slept, were toiling upwards in the night." It's called leadership. I'll give you that again. "The heights by great men reached and kept were not attained by sudden flight. But they, while their companions slept, were toiling upwards in the night." I'll give you an example. The kind of thing I look for in leadership. People come and say they'd like to work on our church staff. One of the things I tell them is this. One of your tasks will be to train and equip and mobilize the lay people in the church. That's critical. That's a critical, important part of it. All these people will put in a 40-hour week before they come to you. So they are giving you 40-plus hours. If you're only interested in a 40-hour week, I trust that you'll find a place of ministry, but it will not be here. We're looking for somebody who's not going to be counting the hours. We're going to be looking for somebody who recognizes you expect more from a leader. That's just one example of it. E, I'm going to really, really move here. E stands for energy. Energy. Energy in physics is the capacity for doing work and overcoming resistance. Energy in the church is the capacity for doing work and overcoming resistance. What I'm talking about here is the ability to keep on keeping on. An inner drive. When I was in the Marines, we were on commando training. At one time, we were out in the field. We were on cliff climbing assault. We used to come in the little boats and send a rocket up on the cliff, and a rope would go up and it would be secured, we hope. And then we'd come out off the little boats as the old things are going up and down with the waves, and grab on the boat and go up these cliffs. We were out for 3 days and three nights, sleeping rough, covered with black camouflage cream. And it was pretty rigorous training. Remember, coming back off those exercises, we were so exhausted that everybody just literally fell on the beds, didn't even take the camouflage cream off, didn't even take our boots off, still had our bayonets and our belts, just totally exhausted. 2 hours after we got onto our beds, the bugler came in to the barrack room and sounded reveille. 2 hours. We hadn't been to bed for 3 days and three nights. Got us on parade, and they took us on a speed march in the middle of the night. I remember saying to one of the instructors when we got back from the end of the speed march, could you give me any idea precisely of what you're trying to do? And he said, yes. He said, we're trying to make commandos out of you. I said, how do you do that? He said, everybody thinks they have a breaking point, but they're wrong. What we do is take them to what they think is their breaking point and then take them through it. And we'll take you into regions that you never dreamt possible. They did it. They did it. Now, of course, I'm not suggesting that everybody should go into Marine Commando training, although I'd love to have some of my staff on Marine Commando training. But what I'm suggesting is this. One thing you would expect from a leader is the energy to keep on keeping on and to be able to draw on resources of energy that they were not aware that they had. I think there's a tendency for us sometimes to give in too soon and to quit too easily. energy. Demonstrating inner resources and resourcefulness. R stands for realism. A leader needs, of all things, to be realistic about three things. Realistic about himself or herself. Realistic about the people. Realistic about the task. Realistic about themselves. Realistic about the people. Realistic about the task. Just one comment about being realistic about yourself. Charles Haddon Spurgeon said, "Beware of no one more than yourself. We carry our worst enemies within us." What a wise statement. Beware of no one more than yourself. We carry our worst enemies within us. Realism about your people. Now, I have a theory here. If you think it's been controversial so far, wait for this. Tell me what you think about it later. Here's my theory. Leadership is determined by followership. Are you with me so far? Very obviously, if no one is following whatever they call you, you are not leading. That is a no-brainer. Actually, there are people who are strutting around in positions of leadership. You can look long and hard for anybody who is following them. But boy, are they great leaders. No. Leadership is determined by followership. The question now is, how do you get people to follow your lead? Here are my three rules. Number one, start with people where they are, not where you think they should be. Start with people where they are, not where you think they should be. Number two, lead them in directions they're prepared to go, not the direction you're determined they're going to go. Number three, move at their speed, not yours. Okay, I'll give you those again. Leadership is determined by followership. How do you get people to follow your lead? Number one, by starting where they are, not where you think they should be. By leading them in the direction they're prepared to go, not the direction you are determined they're going to go. By moving at their speed, not yours. Now, my critics, who are legion, say, that doesn't sound like leadership to me, that sounds like capitulation. Alright? Let's try it another way then. Let's start with people where they aren't. They're over here, and we're over here. But they should be here. The fact that they're over there is irrelevant. They should be here. Because they should be here, this is where we're going to start. They aren't here, but we're going to start here. Now then, we are going to go this way. They've already let us know they have not the slightest intention of going this way, but they should go this way. They should be here, and they should be going this way. So, we're going to start here where they aren't, and we're going to lead them where they won't. Even assuming that they are where they aren't, and will go where they won't, we will not go at their speed, we're going at ours. So even if they knew where we were starting and knew where we were going, they'll very soon lose sight of us because we're going at our speed, not theirs. Here's the question. Who's following at the end of the day? Nobody. If they ain't following, you ain't leading. Now, what do I mean by this? What do I mean is this. If we start with people where they are, not where we think they should be, if we lead them in directions they're prepared to go, not the direction we've decided they're going to go, and if we go at their speed, not us, we will build rapport and we will generate momentum. When you build rapport and you generate momentum, you can steer. if there's no rapport and there's no momentum, you can't steer a stationary vehicle. Now, I know this goes against the grain, and I know that it's very easy to criticize this approach. In fact, I can criticize it for you if you like, but I don't have time. But I would suggest to you that what we need to be thinking about is this. Let's be realistic about people. It is sometimes possible for us to have a very idealistic view of where people ought to be. The reality is they're not there. Now, if we want to be purely idealistic as opposed to realistic, we can simply belabor them all the point of where you should be. But they're not there. Does it not make more sense to get alongside them where they are, rather than belabor them at the point of where they aren't? If it is abundantly clear that they will not or cannot, for whatever reasons it might be, go in the direction we want them to go, can we simply work ourselves into a ladder and become increasingly angry and frustrated with them by trying to get them to go where they won't go? You heard the story of the Anglican vicar who at 3 o'clock every afternoon used to go out to the vicarage, walk half a mile up the road to the bridge over the railway tracks. At 3:15, the train came rushing through, and he would pick up his hat and throw it in the air, and in a way most uncharacteristic of an Anglican vicar until recent times, he would shout, "Hallelujah." Pick up his hat, put it on his head, and walk home. Every day he did this. The bishop heard about this and sent his chaplain to observe this peculiar behavior. And he went up to him and said, "I've observed your peculiar behavior. Why is it that you say, hallelujah, when this train goes through?" And he says, "It's very easy. I get excited at 3:15 every afternoon. That train goes through. It's the only thing that moves in my parish. Without me pushing it." Well, let's face it. If we are spending all our time pushing people to do what they won't do, starting with them where they aren't, going at our speed, not theirs, they get frustrated, you get frustrated, and in the end they either fire you or you give up and go someplace else. Got a better way. Start with them where they are, not where you think they should be. Take them in the direction they're prepared to go, not the direction you've decided they're going to go. Go at their speed, not yours. You'll build rapport, you'll generate momentum, then you can begin to steer them. Be realistic about yourself. Be realistic about the people. One of the things that you can do is encourage people to try what they've never attempted. Give them an entry-level opportunity. One of the problems very often is that we try to get people to do what they have no intention of doing because we're expecting them to start at a level that is totally intimidating to them. Don't do that. Start with them where they are. "You should be able to do this by now. How long have you been a Christian?" "Well, 35 years. "Well, then you should be able to do it by now." The fact of the matter is they should be able to do it, but they aren't. Well, don't spend time telling them what they should be doing. Deal with them where they are. And say, "Okay, well, if you can't do that, how about doing this?" Find something that they will respond to. Be realistic about yourself. You carry your worst enemies within you. Be realistic about your people. Number 3, be realistic about the task. Be realistic about the task. Beware of high-sounding slogans. Beware of unrealistic goals. Beware of setting people up for an inevitable fall. There's a denomination in America that decided that their target for the year 2000 was to develop 100% increase in their churches. They were going to do it very simply. Every church was called to plant a new church. A very, very realistic thing. Goal here. Okay, this is the way we're going to do it, folks. Got everybody fired up. Well, some of the churches obviously did it, and many of them didn't. So the leaders come around and say, come on, folks, we said, you know, we've got to meet our target by 2000, 100% increase, every church plants another church. So what some of them did was they split their churches and sent half the people and called them a new church. And what happened was this, that they split some barely viable churches and produced two non-viable churches and reached their goal. They reached their goal by the simple expedient of producing totally non-viable situations. Be realistic about the task. Don't give them a goal that is going to set them up for a fall. Don't give them a slogan that is going to get them fired up but be totally unrealistic. I'm a child of the Second World War, so I remember quite distinctly being promised as a young boy with the bombs falling around us, I have nothing to offer you but blood, sweat and tears. And he was right. And we embraced it, and the rest, as they say, is history. Realism. S stands for strength. What I mean by strength is strength of conviction and strength of character. Strength of conviction, strength of character. Before I was so rudely interrupted, by the way, I'm almost through because I'm hungry. Here's a cute little piece of poetry. Some men die in battle. Some men die in flames. Most men perish inch by inch while playing little games. What I'm talking about in leadership is strength of conviction. Not dying inch by inch playing little games. Dying with your boots on, dying in the battle, going down in flames. It's not easy. Proverbs 32 verse 1. Hello. Proverbs 32 verse 1. He that raiseth his head above the crowd inviteth a tomato. Slight variation of the tall poppy syndrome. What we're talking about is strength of conviction, strength of character. Thomas Macaulay said, the measure of a man's character is what he would be if he would never be found out. The measure of a man's character is what he would be if he would never be found out. H. This may surprise you, I believe it with all my heart. Prerequisite of a leader is a sense of humor. I stands for integrity. P stands for perseverance. Well, there you are. For what it's worth, some of the characteristics of a Christian leader. Just a word about perseverance. Perseverance should never be confused with pig-headedness. Some people would say, well, we're going to persevere here. What they're actually doing is being just plain old pig-headed. I love what Oliver Cromwell said to the Scottish Presbyterians. I beseech thee in the bowels of Christ, consider that thou mightest be wrong. What a novel thought. Perseverance should never be confused with pig-headedness. Perseverance allows you not to be crushed by failure by giving you the opportunity to learn from it. Perseverance allows you not to be crushed by failure by giving you the opportunity to learn from it. Perseverance will help you not to be deviated by criticism by encouraging you to evaluate criticism. Perseverance is the product of testing, which in the long run is the evidence of maturity.